KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, June 15, 2006, for broadcast at this time. On today's program, we'll hear a discussion of the topic, Immigration Reform, What Should Be Done? The members of the panel include John Condon and John Copenhaver, two private citizens who have frequently made their views known through the public pulse in the Omaha World Herald, and Ben Salazar, publisher of Nuestro Mundo, the Spanish-language newspaper serving the Latino community in Omaha. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of KIOS-FM, the Omaha Press Club, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Kerr, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Other than Iraq, the issue that has gotten the most attention recently is immigration reform. That is the subject of our noon forum today. You will hear both sides of the issue. John Condon and John Copenhaver are local private citizens that have taken a deep personal interest in immigration reform. They are frequent contributors to the Public Pulse in the Omaha World Herald. They are very much opposed to anything that smacks of amnesty for immigrants in this country illegally. The other point of view will be presented by Ben Salazar, the publisher of Nuestro Mundo, the Spanish-language newspaper serving the Latino community in Omaha. Mr. Condon and Mr. Copenhaver will each get 10 minutes to make their presentations, and Mr. Salazar will have 20 minutes. Afterwards, they will take questions. There is paper and pencil at your table. Please write down your questions, and they will be brought to me to ask from the podium. So, John Condon, let's begin with you.
I want to thank Gary Kerr and those affiliated with the Omaha Press Club for giving me the opportunity to speak to you about such an important topic. First, I'd like to put to rest the myth that has been propagated from the President through Congress and the business community. That is, U.S. citizens will not take these jobs that are now held by illegal immigrants. How soon they forget. Every job held by these people were all manned by U.S. citizens, but they were paid a living wage. The question is often asked, what part of illegal don't you understand? Illegal means contrary to law or unlawful. Too many, when talking about immigration, conveniently forget illegal, illegal, to camouflage the issue. McCain's plan has been changed to the Hagel-Martinez plan, which is just as ridiculous as Senator McCain's. It has three steps. Number three, those who have been here 2 years will be deported. Number two, those who have been here less than 5 years but more than two must register, pay a $1,000 application fee, fined up to $3,000, and if they meet qualifications, must leave the U.S. and reapply as temporary workers. Number one, those who are here over 5 years, if they meet all qualifications, will get a green card, permanent legal residence, and pay a $2,000 fine. It is unworkable. Amnesty means to pardon or pardon conditionally. This is amnesty. All have broken the law, but get a job and citizenship and go ahead of those who have waited years to come legally. How many from the two-year category will come forward? Of course, everyone will be in the five-year category. But how does one prove all of this? Do companies have to lie? How many years will this take, and how many millions will be spent? This plan does not eliminate 10 million illegal immigrants who overburden our school and health system, but rewards those who have broken a federal law with a job that sells them U.S. citizenship for $2,000. I don't recall this ever being done before in the history of the United States. The guest worker program passed by the Senate is a travesty imposed on all Americans. It does not solve illegal immigration, and I consider it a turning point in the history of this country. In fact, it will do irreparable damage to all America and its citizens. The only hope left for citizens is that the House will not come out of committee. 87% of Americans are against the guest worker program. President Reagan's solution to illegal immigration was amnesty for 3 million people. The result of that decision is shown today with 10 to 15 million illegal immigrants now here again waiting for amnesty program. While the House addresses the problem, the Senate takes the easy way. I consider the guest worker program the most disastrous piece of legislation to come before Congress in 70 years because it will affect every man, woman, and child in nothing positive. This program lowers our wage standards, which in turn widens the spread between the haves and have-nots. 57% of Americans believe the middle class is decreasing. This law would in short order obliterate the middle class of America, the very class that pays the most taxes and are the largest consumer of goods. Without a living wage, they cannot be consumers, and eventually products made cannot be purchased. It's a rippling effect that this country cannot afford. This bill must not pass, and those who support it must not serve again. You as a voter have the power to change this direction. The only true, quick, proven way to finalize this issue is enforcing present laws that fine employers hiring illegal immigrants. This is an undeniable fact. The cost to deploy National Guard troops is $1 billion, and they have added $500,000 more for detention beds. Both are unnecessary if they enforce fining employers. There are simple methods to check employees, and it is done quickly. It was encouraging to see that the government made an effort to do this in April when they found 1,100 illegal immigrants working for IFCO Corporation in 40 locations through 26 states. Within 24 hours, all of these were back in El Salvador or Honduras, even though mostly were Mexicans. This obviously was a political stunt, and it hasn't been done yet. It's also obvious this could be done every day. A fine of $10,000 per person amounted to $1 million against IFCO, and the fact it only cost $600 each, $660,000, for transportation, the government made $340,000 to continue the project, though Congress said this was impossible because it would cost $57 million. If this were done for 30 straight days, you would see a dramatic withdrawal of illegal immigrants. By eliminating jobs for illegals, there will be no reason to come. This really is the fastest, simplest, and no-cost way to stop illegal immigration. The next thing we hear so much about is illegal immigrants are an asset to this nation. Factually, they are a tremendous burden to our school and medical system, costing taxpayers billions. Florida University studies show that illegal immigrants cost us a minimum of $1,800 per family. National Academy of Science states that immigration labor is not necessary, as such labor contributes 0.1% of a $10 trillion economy. On top of that, California and Arizona each spend $10 billion annually taking care of them. And the state of New Jersey, just recently noted, was paying $200,000 a year, or $200 million a year. It is estimated that 50%, on top of that, California and Arizona each spend $10 billion annually taking care of them. Recently, a federal judge mandated that Arizona spend $185 million to teach English to 154,000 students. It is estimated that 50% of these students will drop out of school. In 2003, these immigrants took $30 billion out of our economy and sent it back to their homeland economy. For years, we have aided and abetted those from our southern border. Never in the history of America can I recall where any other ethnic group has been catered to so much. While over 5 million U.S. citizens are out of work, companies breaking immigration laws hire illegal immigrants at the lowest wage possible, and many times taking advantage of these people. It is outrageous that companies close to allow workers, many illegals, to boycott other industries. It is alarming to see 800,000 people from South America, many illegal immigrants, demanding U.S. justice while carrying flags from other countries they come from. For 250 years, immigrants from Europe and Asia entered this country. assimilated, embraced our culture, and more important, learned English, the one common denominator that has bound this most diverse nation on earth together. Those from our southern border, majority-wise, refuse to do any of these. It is worthy to note that only 19% of eligible Mexicans have become U.S. citizens. Does that show a desire to become a part of America? Senator McCain has not listened to his favorite president. Listen to these words of Theodore Roosevelt in 1907. Quote, "In the first place, we should insist if the immigrants who comes here in good faith becomes an American and assimilates himself to us, he shall be treated on exact equality with everyone else. For it is an outrage to discriminate against any such man because of creed, birthplace, or origin. But this is predicated upon the person's becoming in every facet an American, nothing but an American. There can be no divided allegiance here. Any man who says he is an American, but something else also, isn't an American at all. We have room for but one flag, the American flag. We have room for one language here, and that is the English language. And we have room for one sole loyalty, and that is loyalty to the American people." End of quote. With those words, I must confess, as a World War II veteran, I find it hard to believe anyone who parades with a foreign flag, changes the words of our national anthem and calls it our anthem, refuses to assimilate, accept our culture, or speak our language, desires or deserves to be a U.S. citizen. I heard a U.S. Army Colonel Rodriguez, Mexican descent, say it best, "We're losing our country before our very eyes." In agreement with that, it's sad that those from the South continue to force their culture and language on U.S. citizens while demanding citizenship. To know two more languages is fine, but learn English, and while living here, use it. We cannot divide this nation by language and culture. Please read the literature that Dale Munson will pass out, and I thank you for listening, and I hope I've given you some things to think about. Thank you.
John Condon, thank you. Ben Salazar of Nuestro Mundo, you have 20 minutes.
Muy buenas tardes. Good afternoon. My name is Ben Salazar. I'm a native of Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, born and reared, western Nebraska, which was then and I think still remains a city in Nebraska and not adopted yet by Wyoming. I'm also a veteran. I'm a Vietnam veteran. Served in the U.S. Army between 1966 and 1968. I was drafted by Uncle Sam. I didn't necessarily volunteer. I stand here before you unsure as to whether or not I am a grandson of illegal immigrants or not, because over time the history of my grandparents has been lost, and so we're not necessarily attuned to what happened over those generations that came before us to the United States. But what I do know is that on my father's side, my paternal grandparent came to this country around 1915, 1916. And I believe the story is that he paid 5 cents to cross the river. Actually, it cost him 10 cents, 5 cents for himself and 5 cents for the wife that he stole from Mexico before he crossed the river. On my mother's side of the family, which is predominantly from Sonora, California, and Arizona, they didn't cross the river to come to America. Some of my ancestors had already settled into Arizona and Southern California, so the border actually crossed them when Arizona became a state. I'm very honored to be here today, and I'm going to read from my notes because at this stage of my life, I'm not as spontaneous as I once was, so you'll forgive me if I'm going to read a little bit. I'm very honored to be here today at your invitation. I would like to thank Mr. Gary Kerr for having the courage to track me down, to personally extend this invitation, especially since he had to literally risk life and limb climbing up my crumbling stairway at the house to reach me. When I was a young boy, it was a rare occasion for a white man to come visit us at our home. More often than not, it was an insurance salesman, the priest, or the truant officer coming to speak to my parents about me skipping school. I remember on one occasion my dad telling the truant officer, "Well, don't feel too bad, mister. He misses a lot of doctrina classes, too." I was relieved to discover that on this occasion it was only another forlorn member of the evil satanic cult we call the media. It is a privilege for me to be here today on behalf of my community. I do not take this honor lightly. I'm not an elected official, nor did my community of Latino Americans and Latino immigrants elect to send me here today on their behalf. I am here today as one of their spokespersons because I hope that through my work and my advocacy of positions that are important to us in the Latino community, that I have earned the respect and trust of my fellow Latinos. My sincerest desire is that I fulfill that privilege of trust and respect here today. Before I address directly several of the issues of immigration, I think it's important that you know something about me as a Latino and as an American. I am a 60-year-old Mexican-American, or as many of us native Latinos refer to each other, a Chicano. For those of you who are culturally deprived, a Chicano is a Mexican-American with attitude. I was born in a colony of shanties on the outskirts of Scotts Bluff that was referred to as the Mexican colony. The community that lived in these 25 to 30 dirt floor, three-room shanty consisted of both Mexicans and Mexican Americans. Many of them were my cousins, my grandfather, some uncles and aunts, and lots of brothers and sisters. The reality of my little barrio, which means neighborhood, both in the Colonia and in Southeast Scotts Bluff, which is predominantly Mexican and Mexican American, as well as other barrios or neighborhoods where I have lived over the years, is that they have always been shared by citizens and non-citizens alike. That's essential in terms of who I am today, so that you understand where I'm coming from. Even to this day, at gatherings of family and friends, colleagues and associates, more often than not, in fact, rarely, the last thing that we worry about is whether or not someone among us is carrying a green card or isn't carrying a green card. The way that I and most of my friends and family accept others into our social bosom is based on character, good humor, humility, and sure, sometimes cuteness. I am the fourth born in a family of nine children. I have three older sisters, two younger sisters, and three younger brothers. Both my father and my mother are first-generation Mexican-Americans. My father passed away several years ago, but my mother is still very much alive and active and remains the heart and soul of our family, despite the wear and tear of one bad knee. She is, quite frankly, the strongest person, both physically and spiritually, that I have ever known. Her strength and her spirit are my guiding light. Her positive influence on me and my siblings, and for those who've known her, is manifested through me in spirit whenever I am privileged to speak on behalf of my community. Family for us, and I'm sure for the majority of my Latino brethren, is probably the most important thing in our lives. Without family, without the closeness of family, the strength of family, we become, in essence, lost souls. And one of the things that bothers me more than anything else in this debate over immigration is the harshness and the words that are spoken that stereotype and defile whole scale my Latino brothers and sisters because I know them. I know who they are. I know the strength that makes them who they are. I know how they revere family. I know how important parents, grandparents, great-grandparents are to the structure of the family. And if more Americans truly understood this, truly understood the strength of the Latino community and how it relies so much on the core of the family, I think attitudes would be greatly changed. My father's most important contribution to me, and one which I thank him for every day of my life, is never to take any crap from anyone. Some of my friends say that I've learned that lesson much too well. My father was a blue-collar worker, but his avocation was music. In my barrio, despite the fact that maybe in other places he was seen strictly as just another Mexican, on occasion a Mexican truck driver, on occasion a Mexican factory worker, in his neighborhood and in my barrio, he was very revered as a great musician, as was my uncle. Many of the people in my communities are seen this way. They're stereotyped as just another Mexican, another brown face, another brown person, people standing on the corner, people in the stores. But when you get to know each person in my community individually, and you get to learn something about them, as I'm doing here today with Mr. Congdon as well as you all, you get to learn about what makes them who they are, what makes them human, what makes them react, respond, and speak as they do. And this is why I think it's very important to get away and cut away from these terrible stereotypes that are often applied to us. These are human beings. The blood that flows through my vein is the same blood that courses through their veins. So at times I'm very offended, extremely offended, by these blatant stereotypes that are applied to other members of my community. There are those who may think that in the barrios and ghettos and on the reservations that because we don't have or didn't have many formally educated people that we suffered for lack of mentors. This is a great myth. I still remember fondly those mature men and older boys who looked after us younger Chicanitos with great fondness. They took care of us. They were our older brothers. Mutt Sanchez, for example. Mutt Sanchez was a tall, gangly Chicano, maybe 15, 20 years my senior, who worked out of his pickup truck. I never knew Mutt Sanchez working for a regular employer. He was a first-generation Mexican-American. Mutt was a very strong guy, sinewy, strong. You'd see him driving down his pickup down the road filled with trash, dumping trash, cleaning yards. I greatly admired Mutt Sanchez for his independence. That struck me. This is a Chicano, a Mexican-American, who doesn't care to work for other people. He doesn't care if he's out there picking up trash, picking up iron, searching through for pieces of metal that he can sell. It doesn't bother him because he carries himself with such great dignity. Mutt would hire me on occasion, sometimes on Saturday afternoons, and we'd go and over to one of the local stockyards, and he'd pull up his pickup truck there, and we'd get out, and he'd hand me a shovel, and he'd grab a shovel, and we'd start to shovel manure, and we'd do that for 4, 5, 6 hours a day. We'd fill up his pickup truck full of manure, and he would pay me my money, drop me off at my house, and I'd be very pleased. I was very happy. This is a man that was teaching me things, hauling manure. Now, where he took that manure afterwards, I have no idea, but I'm sure he disposed of it appropriately. But I learned great lessons from someone like Mutt Sanchez. I learned that you don't have to have a PhD or a college education to carry yourself with that dignity, with that independence, that strength, that devil-may-care attitude that, you know, I don't give a damn what anybody else thinks. I'm working here. I'm hauling manure. I'm hauling this, I'm making an honest dollar, and at the end of the day, I collect my money, I go home and feed my family. Mutt also taught me a great lesson, which was, like my dad, never to take any crap from anybody unless you got paid for it. This great debate on immigration is not new to me or to many of us who grew up in western Nebraska. I remember as a young boy standing often in front of the courthouse in Gearing as busloads of young and middle-aged Mexican men shouted out through the windows their last goodbyes to their girlfriends, sometimes their wives, sometimes even their children, as they were getting set to be deported back to Mexico. Tears were flowing. Wails of sorrow and sadness would be shrieked out by the women and kids. I would share that sadness. That would literally break my heart. Even as a young boy, I would watch that, and it would pain me tremendously because I didn't understand all the dynamics of what was happening there. It didn't make sense to me that these guys who were busting their rear ends, working out in the beet fields and potato fields, at corn, the beans, trying to make money to feed their families. Nothing more, nothing criminal. Just trying to work hard and make some money to feed their families. We're being herded like a bunch of cattle, a bunch of sheep, treated like common criminals. Not rapists, not murderers, not killers, not thieves or robbers. Most of these men had great dignity, great honesty to them. In fact, I think that's a lesson that I learned early on growing up in the barrios and colonias, shanties of my neighborhoods, is that among the poor, we rarely had problems with thieves. They weren't allowed. You weren't taught to be a thief. You didn't pick that up from anybody. Robbery, insulting people, demeaning people, you didn't do that. You didn't do that for very long and survive in my neighborhood, because then you were cast as a bad person. Nobody wanted to hang around with a bad person. Those lessons are very important to us. Very important in my community, because we often get these stereotypes again about Latinos being somehow bad people, when in truth they're very honorable people, mannerly people, respective of their elders and other people. You know, you hear stories time and time again of people who love to go to Mexico. Why do they love to go to Mexico? The culture, the language, the songs, the energy, the vibrancy of the people, the way that they're treated. Americans love to go to Mexico. There's a certain irony there. I wasn't alive during the Great Depression, although at times I feel like I was. But I've read enough American history to know that in the 1930s, hundreds of thousands of Mexican and Mexican-Americans, citizens, were deported or literally scared back to Mexico in the 1930s. This also occurred to a lesser degree around the turn of the last century when miners in Arizona demanded to have fair wages for their work. And oftentimes the mine owners would use bullies and armed men to round up these miners, most of them being Mexican, and simply call the local gendarme, and they would be picked up, rounded up, and sent back to Mexico. Over the years of the last century, these deportations, fear and paranoia is nothing new to those of us who live, work, reside in Mexican and Mexican-American communities. In fact, this fear of the immigration authorities is something that's almost handed down generation from generation, even among those of us who are legal. There's this feeling that for whatever reason, even if it never happened to you or your parents directly, that migra, that immigration fellow, is not a very nice guy. You don't want to invite him over for supper or share a beer with him over at the local cantina. The victims of racial prejudices that were most often fueled by paranoia and insecurities based primarily on misperceptions and stereotypes of the worst kind. I've seen and I've read the stories and I've known Japanese-American citizens who were uprooted and incarcerated during the 1940s, entire families who were made to disappear. They were victims also of the same kind of paranoia. There's a debate going on right now about making English the official language of the United States. In fact, I'm paraphrasing, but I believe that part of that language on that debate in the bill itself says that by making English the official language, it would help to unify us as a nation. I don't buy that. What flashes through my mind are images such as those of the young Native Americans back at the turn of the last century who were stripped of their customs and their culture, had their hair cut short, forced into missionary schools, robbed of their language, robbed of their families, to learn English, that great unifying language. It makes me wonder, whatever happened to all those young Native Americans? How unified did they become with America? I don't see any here, and I doubt that there's any in this building. I've known Native Americans my entire life. They're still saddened for the most part, angry. I don't see it as a unifying them or assimilating them into America. Black folks have been speaking English in America for over 400 years. I'm betting that most of them don't buy into this myth that English has been their great salvation in America. Don't get me wrong, the English language, which is what I'm using now, like every other language, is a necessary tool for learning here in America. Cultural, social, and civic norms of a society. Latinos know this. We don't have to be shouted at. It very much offends me when non-Spanish speakers raise their voice at Latinos. That's very offensive. We try not to raise our voices with each other unless someone truly offends you or you're defending something. That's very offensive. Every Latino immigrant that I've ever known over my lifetime understands this concept about learning English. And in fact, studies have shown that by the first generation of Mexican Americans, Latino Americans, Spanish is rarely spoken by the first generation of youngsters. It just doesn't happen that way. There's a gradual, natural assimilation with language. And Latinos are not an ignorant people. Latinos are from what I mean, I'm being egotistical and arrogant about this, but I find my people are very smart and wise people. I greatly admire that. The other notion of assimilation, the notion of assimilation is also, in my view, a myth. A Peruvian friend of mine, a musician who had been here for several years prior to our first meeting, was talking to me one day, and as he talked about the school system and Latinos, he chuckled. He says, "Ben," he says, "you know what they're trying to make out of you Latino Americans here?" I said, "What?" He says, "Brown gringos." And we both had a good laugh. I said, "I agree with you. They're trying hard to make us brown gringos. But we resist because, all in all, I kind of like who I am. I can communicate in your language. But it remains that when we move in, history has shown that white Americans move out. Assimilation, language, we understand those concepts. Latino immigrants understand those concepts. The jobs that Mr. Congdon refers to that Latinos are taking from Americans is based on more myth. It's simply not true. I would love to see more Americans take those hard jobs because, well, I think it would do them a lot of good, to be honest with you, health-wise. We all know what I'm talking about. I think more Americans need to get out there and bust their butts a little bit. I think it'd be very good for them. We've done that. I've been there. And I see Mr. Kerr has risen from his chair, which I think is a notice to me that I'm finished for now, but I'll take questions later. Thank you.
Ben Salazar, thank you. Once again, a reminder, there is paper and pencil on your table, so write your questions down, and they will be brought to me. John Copenhaver, you will end the prepared remarks part of the presentation. John?
Fred? No. Okay. Gary? Plane?
thank you very much. I appreciate being here, Mr. Kerr, and ladies and gentlemen. I don't think any of you can probably see this closely, but you've probably seen this cartoon where these three Central American Indians are referring to these three ships represented by Columbus, and the caption says, "Oh, come on, what's the worst that could happen if we loosen up our immigration policy?" So anyway, I've handed out a four-page handout, and don't go any further than the first page for just a moment, if you will. Number one, I'm apolitical. I'm non-religious. When I'm talking about lawful, I'm talking about legal, unlawful, illegal. And then when I speak of us, I'm talking about the entire American people from a national sort of thing, or the United States of America, and not the United States of North America. And when I speak of the others, basically I'm speaking about illegal aliens. That is, are people who are in our country illegally. I'm going to very briefly cover four areas. Immigration overview, which is the first page on your handout. Immigration terms, very briefly. Some of the costs of illegal immigration. Some myths and this abomination, which is called the Senate Comprehensive Amnesty Bill, which is a sham, which basically is a blueprint for the destruction of America. On the first part of this sheet, on your handout at the top, it says immigration quotes. And on the left-hand side is a controlled, historical, lawful, legal type sort of immigration. And on the right-hand side is effectively what's going on now, which is uncontrolled. It's an invasion, literally, unlawful, and it's illegal. Going down the left-hand side, basically there are four different kinds of classes. This is the government's classes. Immigrants, and the criteria that we're using here today, is somebody who is invited into or permitted to come into the country, generally with the idea of becoming a naturalized citizen. There's also a diversity or a lottery type sort of thing on the left-hand column, about 50,000 per year, and you can reapply and reapply until you get lucky to become an American citizen. Then there are asylums or asylees. These are people who are brought into the United States either because of political problems for asylum or environmental problems, for instance, hurricanes, etc. Usually the idea is not that they're going to become citizens, but they often do. And then the third category is basically a permit category. We are permitting you to come in here, generally time-limited. One primary example might be a student visa. Somebody from Japan comes to UNO and they're here for a year. If they might come for business, or they may want to come to visit Aunt Millie for 2 weeks, but they come in and they say, "Well, gee whiz, I think I'll just stick around because it's too hard for you to catch me, and I'll get a job, and I will become an overstayer, a visa overstayer," which it falls into the last category, which is illegal aliens. The rest of these particular guests were contemporary. I'm not going to go into detail. There's another kind of visa types for the H-1Bs, which are basically high-tech, or the H-2A, for instance, applied to agricultural workers, etc. But these are all have generally, they are permits, but they basically, many of them have time limits to them, not all of them. And then finally, those people who cross into our border, which are uninvited, do so without permission, and which are properly referred to as illegal aliens. Now, there are various other terminologies. Illegal immigrant, which is an oxymoron if you stop and think about it. So they try to soften this, and they say, well, it's an undocumented immigrant or an undocumented citizen or something of that nature, meaning that they don't have any documents, but they really are unlawful. Now, on the right-hand side, there are two driving forces for this. They're the driving forces of abject poverty. And if I were one of these persons from Mexico or South America or Central America, I would do the same sort of thing. There's a problem with this, but what is driving this? In a particular situation in Mexico, it's dysfunctional government. The economy is not able to sustain the people. 95% of the property is owned by 3% of the people, which is entirely different than the United States. All the corporations are owned by 17 families. Mexico has a very number of good things, but they are not taking care of their own people. And what do these people have to do? They're driven out, literally, by the Mexican government on also a voluntary basis. Non-enforcement of our own laws here. We're supposed to have immigration laws, but we are not enforced them. Now, George Bush can stop this in an instant, but he chooses not to. I'll discuss privately why I think he's not doing that, but I won't publicly. Coyotes, which bring these people over, and many of them are really unfortunate. Bush, I've already mentioned. The Senate situation here is another facilitator kind of course, because they're saying, oh, come on over, we're going to give you amnesty, and of course everybody gets around, they come on over. And businesses which employ these people and which really effectively abuse them and actually use them, and that's not right. Religious organizations such as the Catholic Church, Presbyterian Church, Church of Latter-day Saints, which I'm surprised about, also encourage this kind of thing, and they aid and abet in many cases. Activist group, which are more orientated toward the ethnic group, La Raza, which means the race or the people, Lulac, and so forth. On the other side of this thing, the only thing that's stemming this is the Border Patrol. That's down the middle. ICE, which is basically internal. They're not interested in catching anybody down on the border. And the Minutemen are not a governmental agency, but what they do is they go down and they have spotters. The Minutemen have no intent to do anything other than to inform the Border Patrol what's happening. And the House, incidentally, the House bill, it's 4437, the Sensenbrenner's bill, is effectively a security one. You cannot control immigration can't reform it until you can control it. And if you can't control it, you can't control the border. It's just going to keep on coming. Now, on the second and third pages, I'm going to let you look at this as yourself. There's a number of terms here which are popping up, and I'm not going to go into detail with regards to this. Things like assimilation, anchor babies, OTMs, other than Mexicans, and various types of gangs, and some of these. Now, this particular list here has things on it, a couple of them. It's a C chart or C definition, because this is a much abbreviated one, and it just gives you a general idea of what's going on. It's not meant to be complete. Now, cost. Wage suppression in the United States is about $200 billion per year. Harvard Bond House has done a number of studies of this sort of thing. What this means is the lower economic class is being forced out of jobs. In turn, they're not able to take care of their own families. In turn, they don't pay the kind of taxes that we normally have. So that's not good. Workers, particularly illegal aliens, approximately 47% of them are off book. Some of them are being paid by debit cards, so they're not paying any taxes. So they get injured, they're taken down to the local hospital, and effectively they become indirectly, we're paying for their medical behavior. Talking about the cost of food is going to go up, you're going to pay $10 for a head of lettuce. There's been several studies. If they double the salary there, the increase in a head of lettuce would be about 10 cents per head, and a pound of tomatoes about 3 cents. Now, don't be deceived. These jobs are stoop labor, and they're exceedingly hard. And these people, really, basically, a number of years, they have all sorts of medical problems associated. This is not easy. Medicaid, estimating about 10 to 12% fraud. And everybody says, well, there's about 8 to 10 million here illegal aliens. They're probably more like 18 to 24,000. And I could document very strong evidence to indicate that there's well over 15 million, and probably close to 18 to 22. Bear Stone's report and several others indicated this is true. Education, we're educating 1,700,000 students that are legal alien students. How many of you, let me stop for just a minute here. When we talk about immigrants, I wanted to play a little game. These are people that are invited in the United States. How many of you have any idea how many are being entered per year? Any guess? I don't want to embarrass you. 500,000? 750,000? A million? Over a million. We enter more people in the United States than all the other countries in the world. Well, anyway, we have 31,000 ESL students in the state of Nebraska. Nobody really knows how many of their illegal students, but let's just cut that in half, because I'm sure that encompasses at least $8,000 per student. And if you multiply that, we're paying $120 million a year for illegal students that should not be here, and our own students are not getting an adequate education. Now, it's not all due to that, but it's a very expensive amount. We have, as of October of 2004, we had over 250 illegal aliens in Nebraska State Correctional Facilities at $28,000 per year, and Nebraskans pay $25,000 per individual. The other 3,000 comes back to us from the federal fund. One of the biggest problems, and this has impacts personally, are on Social Security fraud. And they have this lady here who her Social Security card was sold, in a flea market in Texas. The IRS got after her, said that she owed over $1,500,000 in taxes, back taxes. She was arrested on a plane. This goes on daily, and I'll bet you a nickel. Is it true or false that if your ID, Social Security card, is stolen, that the Social Security will notify you? It's false. They don't do that. And they don't talk to the IRS. It's incredible, and it's going on. We have 29.3% in federal prisons at $35,000 a person that are illegal aliens. That's almost 30%. It's an incredible thing. They're average, they're just a recent study, there are 240,000 child molestations, and they're released back in the population. Court systems are overwhelmed. Well, anyway, there are a lot of problems associated with this, and I just want to touch briefly on some of these myths, and then I'll close up here. Many illegal aliens do not want United States citizenship. They have a home. All they're interested in doing is filling themselves with free education, benefits, subsidized basically by middle Americans. Now, I'm not saying that personally. There's a lot of good Latinos, Hispanics, whatever you want to call them, but I'm talking about in a general class. There are no jobs that Americans want to do. There are plenty of them. Just pay them a decent wage. Illegal aliens are not critical to the economy. They really are not. They're very small for that matter. This is not an immigrant nation. If you stop back, this has not been an immigrant nation since about 150 years ago. And most people in this probably, with a few exceptions, probably would have to go back to your grandfathers or great-grandfathers before you could find somebody to come in. I have to go back at least six generations, and I'm not even sure about that. The United States is not a welcoming United States. Well, that's wrong, because we integrate, we invite or allow over a million immigrants per year. Mexico is not a friend of the United States, and that's true. Mexico is using, you ought to know about their immigration policy, you wouldn't want to know about it. It's not racist to secure borders. Well, I'm going to stop there because I have some handouts, which I'll be happy to be welcome to, but I am getting sick and tired of this kind of thing. I got a belly full of that. I think you've all seen this. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
You bet.
All right. Let's get on to some questions here now. John Condon, what's wrong with the program of allowing people to come into this country as workers? As long as they go back again after the work is done, don't most illegals want to go back but are afraid they won't be able to get back to the U.S. to make money they need to make to sustain their families back home?
Well, the simplicity of it is that there is a legal way to come to the United States. And I think a good way to answer that question in relation to the Senate proposal. The Senate proposal says if you're here 2 years, you go back. That's approximately 2.5 million people. From 3 years to 5 years is another 2.5 million people. That's 5 million people that are being deported. And supposedly, this is all voluntarily, remember. They're all supposed to come out of the shadows and show up and tell them how long they've been here. When you analyze all that, this is the words of President Bush last week. It contradicts completely what he proposes and stands by. He quotes, "There are those here in Washington who say, why don't we just find these folks and send them home? That ain't going to work," he says. He said, "Although it sounds simple, it is impractical to insist that 12 million illegal immigrants estimated to be living in the United States to leave and come back legally." That's exactly what the Senate proposal is, and he says it isn't going to work. And he stumps the country telling you this is the program we should support. These are his exact words. He contradicts what the whole Senate proposal is. So I say there is a legal way to come to the United States, and that's the way they should come.
Ben Salazar, you have any comments on that?
Well, obviously I do, Gary. First of all, every one of us here in this room today, whether you wanted to admit it or not, is benefiting from the work or the byproducts of illegal immigrants, whether it's in the form of lower food costs, whether or not maybe you had construction work done in your home, people that were working up on your roof, people that pick up your garbage, cut your stakes. Every one of us here is benefiting from that work. I'm not a big supporter of any of the plans that are currently on the table. I have no reservations telling you or anybody else that as an American, these folks are good people. They're hardworking people. They're a youthful part of the community. America, believe me when I tell you this, is getting older. And there's a lot of concern among health workers that as the baby boomers, which includes myself, get older and sickly and disabled, that the care is going to come from, to a large extent, many of the folks that are here without papers. And that's the truth. One of the most positive aspects that I've seen of young people, teenagers, who I've spoken to in classrooms and asked what are their ambitions in life, you'd be amazed, I was amazed, at how many responded when we mentioned health care. Many of these young people who are here with their parents' aid because of their parents, who are here without papers, want to get ahead. They want to work with the elderly. They want to work in medical institutions. They want to be helpful. But these kinds of legislations are going to prevent them from doing that. And we ought to consider that carefully because it's one of these young people that could very well be caring for you, your neighbor, or somebody else in your family in the next 5 or 10 years, including myself.
Mr. Copenhaver, would you make exceptions for those workers who pay taxes, learn English, and make an effort to become good citizens?
Well, the point is that they don't have to learn English. All they have to do is they have to sign up for a class. That doesn't mean that they learn English. And the hope, what was the first part of the question? They have to learn English, and what was the other? Gary?
It's what?
What was the second part?
Well, it was, would you make exceptions for those workers who pay taxes, learn English, and make an effort to become good citizens?
Well, the last is subjective. I don't know what making an effort to become a citizen is. Taxes is there. Why? You know, I have to pay taxes every year. As the way this thing is structured here, they get to pay taxes only every other year. And, you know, this excuse me fee of $2,000 or whatever, I think the answer is no, because basically we have not had any control on it. And the issue, basically, to never start, is you have to control this thing at the border. The second thing is you have to make strong enforcement as far as employers, and the rest of it will take care of itself. So I guess the answer to it is no.
This questioner would like all three of you to answer this. John Copenhaver, let's begin with you. Just suppose that all illegal aliens were deported. What happens to their children of all ages who were born in the U.S. and are therefore American citizens?
Okay, number one, this is the 14th Amendment. And it says in the particular amendment, it says that under the United States jurisdiction, I don't see how, these are referred to as anchor babies. I do not see how you can interpret that. Most countries do not have this sort of phenomenon. And if they have, they've gotten rid of it. So I don't think that if this is, and it will be brought to a constitutional test for the Supreme Court not too far from now, I think that they will find this unconstitutional. Now, let's just assume that they are American citizens. When you enter the United States, it's a responsibility of the parents. There's also the point is that I suspect that a lot of these people would like to have a baby because effectively that says 18 years from now you can bring in a family and so forth. It's an anchor baby. So the question basically is up to the parents. If they want to leave the child with an aunt or an uncle, that's fine. Or if they want to take them back to their home country, that's fine too.
John Connor, anything to add to that?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with that. We're the only nation in the industrialized world who allows anchor babies. For you people who have moved from one city to the other, when you move, you usually take your kids with you. And those people who are unfortunate who have made it across the river illegally and now have to go back, it would only be logical to me that they would take these quote-unquote American citizens with them. They're their children, and it's the responsibility of the parents to take their children with them, just as you and I did when every time we moved. I would see no reason why they wouldn't go with their parents when they went back. and get in line and come back in, just like we expect the average person of the million that come here each year.
Ben Salazar, any comment?
Yeah, Gary. I think history has shown, especially when we go and look back at what happened during the 30s and the mass deportations during the Depression, that, in fact, families would go back whole-scale, for example, to Mexico along with their children, so that Mexico would, if this turned out to happen, be home to many hundreds of thousands of American citizens. That's what would result more than likely. It's unlikely that Mexican immigrant families or other Latino immigrant families would leave their children in the care of strangers or even relatives solely because their children happened to be born here. I don't think that, for the most part, parents are that callous. And I'm a little uncomfortable with the terminology of anchor babies. As a Mexican-American, as an American, you know, one of the things about growing up as a Chicano that you discover over time is that even though we're surrounded by American culture and slang, and I know quite a bit of it, these terms are still unusual to me. I remember once in college, I was talking to a couple of guys from Grand Island, and they said, well, you know, it might have a Mexican standoff here. And I turned to them, I said, a Mexican standoff? What is that? He said, well, you're Mexican, Ben. You should know. I said, well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't even know what a Chinese fire drill was. And you know, these guys are trying to tell me, you know. I said, that's how unacculturated I am. And I'm still that way. I'm still learning about Americans and the slang and the culture. If you can call it that, these terms are still foreign to me. And so even at this stage in my life, I'm still learning about Americans. But I think it would be a natural trend for parents to take their children with them. I think that would just happen that way.
Well, we thank you very much. We have come down to the end. We have no more time. I've got some other questions here. I'm sorry I didn't get to all of them. But our thanks to the audience here at the Press Club today, to our KIOS radio audience, and, of course, to our three panelists, John Condon, John Copenhaver, and Ben Salazar. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We've heard a discussion of the topic, immigration reform, what should be done. The members of the panel included John Condon and John Copenhaver, two private citizens who have frequently made their views known through the public pulse in the Omaha World Herald, and Ben Salazar, publisher of Nuestro Mundo, the Spanish-language newspaper serving the Latino community in Omaha. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, June 15, 2006, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. If you'd like to attend future forums in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.